CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, all right. Tuesday's here. It's the 21st of September. My God. It's like just yesterday we were talking about Spring Day. That's where we're at. Kind of ridiculous. We've got Lebang, we've got Bulelo, we've got you, we got me. What else could we possibly want? It's all going down this morning. Lots to talk about too. Some interesting guests popping in this morning. Among others, we'll have a little visit from our friend JJ Cornish. It's brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. We'll find out from him what's happening in Africanalysis. And there is, as usual, quite a lot going on. So that's coming up. We'll also start something new this morning called This Is Us. And This Is Us is a really interesting new thing that we're going to be doing on the regular. And I think you're going to enjoy it because I don't know about you, but there's so many people who walk around wondering what it is to be South African. And there's so many things that happen in this country that are confusing. Sometimes they're good things and they make you feel good about being South African. Sometimes they're bad things and they make you wonder if it is a good thing to be a South African. But we're still trying to figure out who we are. And I think that this morning, this is probably one of the ways that we'll get closer to figuring that out. And it's all coming up a little bit later on. So loads of things to get you thinking, loads of things to get you up and about and to start your day off properly. So, yeah, welcome to the show. Welcome to this morning and welcome to spring and September. Sure.
How are you feeling, Gareth?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling very good.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know what? Feeling healthy. Feeling happy.
Good.
I haven't really prioritized sleep recently, so I'm probably about a couple of hours off my ideal sleep time, which you've got to get good at. If you really want to be like in top gear, you have to get enough sleep. And I don't prioritize that. Like if I'm interested in something or I'm busy working on something, then that gets priority and then the sleep gets pushed to the back burner. It's never a good thing.
Yeah. How old's your bed?
My bed is probably, I got a new like mattress for it. It was maybe about 3-4 years ago. So it's good. It's good to go. And I sleep well on it. It's just that I don't go to sleep. Mbulelo. It's not that I'm comfortable and, you know, none of that stuff, but it's like discipline. And also, I don't know that I'm physically tired enough because, you know, most of the time now when you're working at home, and I go into the office twice or three times a week, depending, you're not as physically exhausted by the time you get home. And even though I do exercise during the day, I do that in the morning. So it's the afternoons that are the problem. You know, I've got to do something. Maybe
you should try get an app.
You mean like to count my steps and shit?
Not to count your steps, to tell you that, look, it's time to sleep. If you don't sleep now, then this is what's going to go wrong, blah, 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 blah. It sounds like a bit much, but it actually works. Because, like, I tried it, and I've slept so many more hours since, and I just feel so much better since. And I have the same problem as you. Like, I'm working so much, and I love my work so much that I just want to do my work. But you realize that you need the sleep in order to be able to do your work better.
I do have an app for that. It's called Listening to My Body. When I'm tired, I just sleep. But, I mean, obviously, that's not always possible.
Let me stop you there. That's a terrible app. Awful what you've
really?
Said.
Really?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, as soon as you said how I feel. Is a guy called Matt Walker, if you want to look him up and really get into the sleep thing. You know, is sleep actually shapes all of your productivity from what the neuroscience is telling us. So a guy called Matt Walker, really, really interesting guy. He tried to bring sleep into sort of the forefront of neuroscience a while ago, and he didn't get his shine. And now he's starting to really come to the fore. And about 5 years ago, I saw a sleep specialist, and it really did change a lot for me. Yeah, yeah. So you can look up Matt Walker. I mean, it is a discipline. And it affects everything. It affects when you're actually most productive. How you know that? We can tell. You know, the coldest body temperature you have is 2 hours before you wake up, is what the science says. That'll tell you actually when you're most productive, because the science leans to about 6 hours after your coldest body temperature of the night, which is generally in the circadian rhythm, 2 hours before you wake up, if you've got your circadian rhythm set.
That's probably about 3 a.m. You can work it out. All right.
So you can, there's a lot of things you can
work out.
So what
must I do with that? What must I know? So I know my body's cold at 3 a.m. So how does that help me?
Well, then you know when you'll be most productive in the day. Because
it's
they say
6 hours after that, no?
Give or take, yeah. So anyway, I can see your face already. Go and have a look at Matt
Walker. It sounds like astrology. It sounds like Virgo and Cancer and Pisces and tarot cards.
No, unfortunately, this guy actually has a doctorate and teaches at Stanford. He doesn't live in Rosebank and have interesting carpets.
You know what? Mbulelo, I've become less and less impressed by people with degrees in the last couple of years. I don't know about you guys, and this is maybe something we have to talk about, because there are parents who are spending an absolute fortune. There are people who are putting themselves through university that costs an absolute fortune, and they're coming out with all these degrees. And I don't know that all of them are equally valuable, or that we haven't put degrees on such a pedestal in this world, because a tertiary education has become the golden fleece of all endeavors. People have nothing going on except what they learn on university campuses these days. And I do think that a lot of it is absolutely worthless. I really do. It's a controversial thing to say, but it's putting huge swathes of our population into massive student debt. These universities are not necessarily churning out anything better than they're taking in. And I think we've always let universities just get away with being their own judge of a standard. I mean, they self-regulate, right? Which is not a bad thing if things are healthy. If things are healthy, like sleep, you should be able to self-regulate. When they get unhealthy, then how do we recalibrate them? And I see people coming out of these universities now, and they're still not getting jobs, right? Now, the whole point of the Industrial Revolution method of instruction is that you should be able to come out of an institution like a university, and you should be able to get a job. And that's not happening. So they are not doing their job in trying to get people meaningful and gainful employment. So we even spoke to Weza the other day about engineering. And even that, a discipline which is entirely scientific, non-ideological, supposed to be churning out people who the economy needs the most. If you were looking at this as a kind of centralized system, that could be, you could assign people jobs and they would have to do them. Even that's not working. Engineering isn't even working. Makes me think it's time to reevaluate the whole thing with universities. Are they really doing their job? And do we need to be putting so much pressure on young people to go and spend a huge amount of money and about 3 or 4 years of their lives, sometimes more, learning something which is not going to necessarily guarantee them any advantage in the real world? How many times do you meet someone with a BA or a BCom or even a BSc, frankly, and they haven't got something to do? And yet universities continue to have this reputation for being great places to learn things. Now, there obviously are certain courses which are handy and which have cred. But even they are starting to become a bit tainted, if you ask me. Even the ones that we've taken very seriously, like engineering and medicine and, you know, the sciences more generally. Even those, we're starting to look askance at, don't you think? It's time to question these things.
It's definitely been time. I mean, guys, it's a very layered topic. There's multiple reasons how we got here, why society has put, you know, varsities on pedestals, why parents have put varsities on pedestals. I mean, there's very, very layered reasons. We all kind of know, especially as a country, how we got here. But the real thing is, you know, who's going to hold the schools accountable? If nobody's calling them out, they will continue to think what they're doing is okay. I mean, now more than ever, we're seeing a bunch of Gen Zs literally choose to not go to school, choose to sit at home and learn everything on Google and on YouTube, choose to actually just be their own, you know, their own deciders of how they're going to do life. Versus back in the day, you didn't have a choice. It was, look, you're going to school or else you will have nothing to do with your life. And now more and more you're seeing people that have degrees standing on the side of the robots with a placard begging for work.
No,
that's when you know it's bad. That's when you know it really needs to reevaluate.
And Space Brothers says it's about the person. If you don't have drive and ambition, the degree will not give you that. A person with that, however, can utilize the degree to its full potential. I agree, but still, you know, we gave up on post-1994, we gave up on things called technicons in this country. And I do believe we've lost an enormous amount of value in our economy by not focusing on technicons. Now, Their purpose was to provide everyone from architects, which is now obviously just a degree, but you used to be able to get diplomas and things like that, to people with actual skills. You know, someone who can fix something, whether it's a laptop or a cell phone or a burst geyser or a shelf.
An artisan.
An artisan or a person who is a master and before that an apprentice or a skilled person in something. We don't make these people anymore. We're making a whole bunch of people with degrees in various theoretical and applied ideas, which just doesn't help them. Like, you know, when you need to get a container from A to B, you need a truck driver. When you need to build a house, you need a bricklayer. When you need to make a road, you need someone who is a skilled engineer at that. There are different requirements along the way for all these kinds of people, and I wonder where we're churning them out, because those are things that we don't have anymore. And I think that the skills are going to be far more valuable in the future than the degrees. They're already showing themselves to be. And it gives someone an enormous sense of achievement and accomplishment when they have an ability to say, I've got a degree. But it doesn't guarantee anything other than that. And I know loads of people with degrees who are stupid, right? Stupid. And I know some people who don't have degrees who are super, super smart.
Yeah, I think the pendulum always swings this way. It's like, okay, like in reality, we all know we need educational institutions. Let's not be ridiculous, you know, is that now that it's the age of me, everyone wants to think they can do it by themselves, but they can't really, because you need to send 20-year-olds to university because they need to learn that you can't always have stuff your own way, and you have to play with other kids, and there's other people, and there's just no leave me on my own on the internet that can teach you that, whether you like it or not. And we don't have a better idea
but unfortunately, right now. Universities aren't doing that at the moment because people can't even go to normal campuses and do normal stuff. I mean, they haven't opened up normal classes like they have had in past years because of this corona thing. So what you're talking about is hugely important, but it's not happening at universities anyway. And they're still charging the same, as I understand it, which is crazy.
But you're not gonna just because you have a paper cut doesn't mean you chop your leg off. It's like COVID's not gonna last forever.
I'm agreeing with you from that point of view. Like you know, don't break down the fence until you realize that someone built it.
Yeah.
Right. So I
think I have to agree with you to an extent. And I have a huge problem even in university. And I am one of those idiots that you're talking about. But BA degrees, somebody needs to still explain to me why they take up 70% of universities.
Well,
that I don't understand.
They should be there, but they're not as practical and useful in the real world. And I mean, I'm saying that as someone with, that's my humanities is my background. That's what I did at university, you know, political science and history. I mean, it's interesting, but it's certainly not useful or practical. And I paid for all of that myself with work that I did after school. My parents refused to pay it because they said it was a waste of time. They were ready to pay for law, and I never got that degree. So, you know, I'm a graduate of that kind of system. And while I found it interesting and there were great lecturers and I learned things that I might not have learned prior to the internet era, it's completely worthless to me. I don't even list it among my accomplishments at all. Couldn't care less. I tell people I did read law for 4 years. That's the sum total of what I tell people about my tertiary education. I didn't finish, but I did law. That's what I'm interested in telling.
I was there.
I could care less. Like, it's totally, it's not a thing to me. And when I see these people who are wholly obsessed, I mean, you even see it with matrics, right? And we're about to do matric exams in South Africa now, which is always a scary thing, because you see these young people, some of them very fragile, who've been told that everything rests on them doing this thing well. And you see the enormous pressure that we put on these young people that, oh my God, if you don't get your matric, you're never going to be amounting to anything in your life. You're a disaster from beginning to end. Sure, it's one way to separate the good from the bad in terms of employment and are you going to hire people based on credentialism? But I don't hire at Cliff Central. Like Rena does that. And she's got years of experience and she's smarter than me. And she says she doesn't look at people's CVs. It may be interesting, may give you a little bit of background on that person, but she doesn't care what they're qualified in. She cares a little bit about their experience because that obviously helps. But to her, it's about these things that somebody said in the comments just now. This Space Brother, he said that it's about the person's ambition and drive and determination and their willingness to do whatever it takes to make things work and to win. And I think that's terrific information. That's really helpful. So a lot of people agreeing with me and other people disagreeing with me. Errol says, my dad became a millionaire without a matric. I wanted to study law, but I never got that right, says Robin. Bulelo, you're wrong. Have you ever tried doing something yourself using a tutorial? I've been servicing and maintaining my car since lockdown. The small things. I know I'm slow, but I get it done. Yeah, you know, think about how you can learn to play the guitar by watching YouTube videos now. That has not made the people who learn to play guitar via YouTube any worse than the people who've learned from a master guitar player, right? Like a session muso or something. Because that session muso is now doing this stuff online anyway. And I do think degrees like philosophy or history or even political science, which is really one of the dumbest degrees you can do. I say that having done it. Waste of time. Like if your parents don't make you pay for that yourself, then they are wasting their money. Honest to God, I say that as someone who's had to do exactly that. If you expect your parents to pay for a degree in history, politics, language, any of that stuff, then you are abusing your parents, and you should actually have to pay it back every single cent. Really stupid.
Any degree without maths.
But how we how did we get onto this discussion? We did because you told me, oh, there's a sleep guy, which is great. He may be unbelievable, but how did you say he was unbelievable? Stanford or Harvard or those institutions are so sclerotic and backward now. They are such repositories of what in an argument people refer to as argument from authority. Like, because I've got this, I mean, I know people who've got Stanford and Harvard and Yale and Columbia University degrees. I know some of these people. I see them regularly. I talk to them regularly. Some of them I'm even working with half the time. And I must tell you, they're not that much more special than any of the guests we've had who are just YouTubers. Really?
Yeah. Like, when you strip that degree away, what's left of you? Who are you really?
Right.
And also, a lot of these places that give this great, you know, all these great courses and this great education, they really are becoming outdated. Like you're saying, Gareth, even I went to UP. I think you did as well, Gareth. Like when I look back now, I'm like, yo, why was I even struggling with that subject? Why did I need statistics 101? Why did I go through 4 years of economics? There's things where even back then I was like already questioning why I'm doing them. And the fact that they still have those courses now is just, yo.
Look, I think there's also something to be said for learning to learn, and school doesn't teach you that properly. And some people have a hunger for it, and I always mark that as the sign of intelligence, not how much they know, but how much they want to know. So when I meet someone and they are just curious about everything and they ask a lot of questions and, you know, almost like a precocious child, then I'm like, that is the perfect person to go to university because maybe there's someone smart enough on that campus to be able to answer their questions, especially if it's in a field which does require an enormous amount of concentration and effort. And I'm not saying close down the universities, but I'm thinking that parents have to ask themselves a couple of times, is this really me just trying to satisfy myself that my kid will be independent and get out there and find a job? Or is it because I really feel I want them to learn? Because I don't think a lot of I don't think a lot of people go to university to learn. I think they go to university because they want the degree so that they can get jobs.
That's all that it is. And also, like, with that pressure, a lot of our parents just want to be able to sit in circles and speak highly of their kids. Like, oh, no, my kid's got this degree. My kid's got that degree. A lot of the reasons why we end up doing the things that we do, again, as I said earlier, Gareth, it's just because of circumstance. It's because school was the only option. If it wasn't school, then you're either a policeman or a nurse back in the day. It's as per my mom. You know, that's all you could do, or become a teacher. And if you didn't want to do those three, then you were screwed. So when, as soon as we were allowed to do school, it was like, boom, that's it. That's all you can do. That's it. So as soon as the goalpost gets shifted, now it's like you can get the degree, but now you have to have connections. It's like, how? Then why did we put all this pressure on you know, young Black kids to work this hard to get the degrees? Now they're just sitting in debt. It's crazy.
And that debt is huge, and that's crippling. I mean, listen to this. Robin even says it costs 30,000 Rand a year to go to a private academy just to study hairdressing. Now, that sounds like a bit of graft, grift, if you ask me. And I wonder how much of this stuff is actually attached to its real world value. Like this, because the market dynamics don't come into play, right? No one compares the cost of X university to the cost of Y if they only got into X. So once they've let you in, you just have to pay. And they get to determine that price. Now, if you're doing a degree in philosophy, and they say to you, well, it's going to cost you 80,000 Rand a year. I don't know if that's a lot or it's a little in universities. Maybe it'll cost you 80 grand for the whole degree. But you come out a philosopher. I'm so sorry for whoever's paying that bill. It's great. We need philosophers. But these days, the best philosophers are to be found in podcasts and on YouTube, not at universities.
But you know, I think we can all agree the world is becoming a safer place to live. More and more people have food to eat. It's becoming easier. The population of the world isn't going to decrease. We expect to hit, if calculations are correct, I think 10 billion in about 2050, give or take, right? So how do we organize these people? Whilst it's nice to have anecdotal evidence of is we have to still have these organizations to organize people. And a really interesting thing, and you just kind of touched on it there, is that excellence cannot become a matter of subjective thought. Is we still need objective standards of excellence. Can you do mathematics? You're excellent. We will reward you. Mm. Can you do neuroscience? You're excellent. But we will reward you. I know it's this time of old sucks. Everybody always, these institutions, they're terrible. They're outdated. Yeah. Okay, there are parts that are terrible. Like nothing's perfect.
Let me ask. I just want to ask Lebang this because you got four kids, right?
Yeah.
Now, are you going to put all four of them through university?
Sure. I mean, yeah. I think ideally I'd like to just like figure out from a passion perspective what it is that they want to do. So I don't waste my money and so that they don't waste my money.
Because if all four,
what is it that you want to do? If you can study in it, sure.
If all four of them want to go, you better take out a second mortgage on the house now. I mean,
dude,
you better save everything. You better sell everything you've got because that's going to cost you an arm and a leg.
I know. I pretty much know. I'm hoping that maybe two of them, you know, is going to, by the age of 17 or 18, already have like a career in acting going, and the other one will be like a rapper. Like, I'm just hoping that not all of them are going to want to go the traditional routes and study some shit and then go work a 9-to-5. I know, I'm not like that. My partner's not like that. I don't think any of my kids are going to want, maybe one or two will fall into it, but I know that they're going to really want to explore the world and travel, and I'll just ship them off and, you know, go backpacking, and the other one can. I know I'm not going to have to pay for four kids going to university because I hated university. I don't expect any of them to love it. Maybe one or two, though.
Captain
Levan said a great word there.
Yes, go ahead. Jared,
sorry. She said passion. And I was really fortunate to meet one of my heroes in a pretty cool job I had at UCT. And I was mediating a talk by a great man called Sir Ken Robinson.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen his speech on, because I love, you know, I'm more autodidactic, but I love, as you do, Gareth, and I don't know Lebang well enough yet, but I do love the pursuit of knowledge. And
isn't Ken Robinson Ken Robinson the so-called father of the internet?
No.
Am I thinking of the same person?
No. So this Sir Ken Robinson was an educator, but he speaks about passion. And there's a very famous speech that he did online. You can go and look it up on passion. But his thing is to spread. And you said it beautifully earlier, was that it should be about the pursuit of knowledge, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. An ex-girlfriend of mine used to put it perfectly. Don't learn for the marks, learn for the knowledge.
Right.
But the way Sir Ken speaks about it, he's got some great books. So the passion thing is important. How to instill that appetite to learn.
Well, Captain,
and then maybe it changes the conversation.
Captain Cook says got a university degree, then got a technical degree, and the technical degree is much more useful. Well, that's almost in the words, so to speak. But it's also like, you know, things are changing so quickly that it is better to go to university to learn about all kinds of things, to become a generalist, and then figure out later on if you want to specialize. And obviously there's some things that are extremely specialized. You know, if you're going to go in and become an eye doctor, for example, an ophthalmologist, you will need to study a very particular set of things, and you'll probably only be able to do that in a university. And there'll be practical things that you need to do as part of that degree, which you could never do on the internet. That we all understand. But there are jobs, and jobs are changing so much now. The kind of work, like imagine being a video game developer, right? There's no degree for that at most colleges and universities in the world. There may be one or two have started to give those. But if you're a video game developer, I mean, that's a burgeoning field where really smart, really interesting, really creative people are sitting mostly on their own, coding and playing around with different ideas and dynamics and code and game, and, you know, coming in with characterizations and storylines. And there's a huge overlap between the stuff that you have to feel and understand about the world generally, and then the stuff that you need to do practically in terms of actually creating the code that will make X deliver Y. And those people, they're not catered to by this tertiary education situation. How about people who fly drones? You know, there's a whole business that's opened up and created jobs in the last 5 to 10 years in a way that we could never have foreseen. How about people who program ethics and rules for self-driving cars? You know what I mean? That's where you would have had an old philosopher degree come in and now have to sit with technical people and decide, you know, if the Tesla is moving towards a stop street at X kilometers per hour, now maths comes into it and physics and everything as well, and there are two old people crossing the road, but if it doesn't slow down in time and it has to take out the old people, it will save the lives of 6 children who it would otherwise have hit if it can't, you know, whatever the situation may be. Someone has to sit there and figure out, calculate what's going on. This is a new problem for humanity. It's a problem we've never had to deal with before. And this requires brilliant people with brilliant minds, but not necessarily someone with any specific degree. Do you see what I mean?
And it's happening more and more, Gareth. It's not just to the extent of coding and video games. I'm going to even bring it right down to designing. Graphic design. Now there's literal apps that you can just download to design for you. Logo creating, any sort of brand element. Right. There's so many things that you don't actually need to sit and do yourself and unpack one by one. And I was speaking to a video editor that I used to work with, and he was shit scared. He's like, I don't think I'm going to be relevant anymore, because he's been editing since he was 7, and now he's like maybe 30. He's like, I don't think that I'll be relevant in the next 10 years, because number one, these kids are coming up with their own concepts of editing, and these are all self-taught. These kids sit at home and just learn and learn and learn. And the stuff they churn out is stuff that he could have never turned out having learned and studied this in the past however many years. So it's quite scary where we're going, you know? Most basic jobs, like...
I mean, Lawrence says, I'm currently studying 3D modeling. Now, that's a really interesting thing to do. And to be able to do that, you know, AutoCAD and rendering and all of that stuff, that's phenomenal. Again, do you need a degree in that, or is that something that you can learn yourself just sitting in trial and erroring? I mean, how did you learn to use a computer? Because I never had any formal courses. I didn't do any of this.
What do you mean?
I saw it. Well, in primary school, there was that, you know, little bit of typing, blah, blah, blah. But if it's there and you play around with it long enough, that's how I remember learning.
Did you not do computer science at school?
Mm-mm.
No.
What?
No. Computer science.
No, we didn't have computer science.
What's computer science?
I think it was an optional, but we didn't take it because the teacher wasn't a very serious person. I mean, like it was kind of a joke. It was a joke subject. It was like phys ed or like technical drawing.
Like, you know?
No. No, you're talking about computer studies. I see where you've made a mistake. So I know the computer science where you're doing programming in school.
No,
there's two different ones.
We never had.
What schools are these? Yeah, we didn't have that.
Remember, what we had at my time. I'm so old now that the only thing that we could do in computer.
I didn't mean anything
with computer in it when I was at school was like MS-DOS, dude. You know, we're not talking
coding,
HTML stuff. There was none of that shit. There wasn't an internet. What are you talking about? You know,
dial-up. We were still like busy with the dial-up.
I didn't even have that at school. We didn't have dial-up internet when I was at high school. That's how old I am. So
it's at this stage I have to acknowledge my naughties privilege.
Yes, of course. There
I have to create a safe space for you, an MS-DOS safe space to say, there we go. You know, that's on me.
That's why I couldn't. It wasn't a serious thing while I was at school doing it, but it did become one. And those people who hopped on that bandwagon early are the people who invented all the apps that we use now, you know. And some of them are a lot younger than that, but that was the first generation of people who did that. And thank God for them. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do this show this morning, you know? So I just want to quickly go to some headlines before we get to Jean-Jacques Cornish for Africanalysis. So first of all, apparently the city of Cape Town has been slammed over shifting blame for housing delivery. This is an ongoing thing. Again, we live in a country where a whole lot of people are waiting for something to happen for them, and the government is the organ that has to deliver these things. And when it doesn't happen, the people get really cross because otherwise they don't know what to do, right? They're not self-sustaining. And the city's been slammed for shifting the blame for its housing crisis to criminal disruptions after it said housing projects had been severely impacted by a surge in gang violence, extortion rackets, sabotage, and theft. Human Settlements mayoral committee member Malusi Boy said in less than 2 years since February last year, those instances of criminality had cost the city more than 131 million rand. He said, in the 5 years since 2017, the city had to spend more than 143 million, indicating a surge in those incidents in recent months. That was more than double the amount spent in the previous 2 years to counter criminality. So I'm not sure what the problem is here, or whether or not this is just a pre-election thing to make the DA look bad in Cape Town, when everyone else by comparison looks worse all the time, because no one bothers to hold them to any standard. You know, when there's a standard, as there is for Cape Town, even though it's a standard which is controversial. People always saying, oh, there's such inequality. Like, there's inequality in other parts of the country that's better. You know what I mean? It's like this this idea that there are a separate set of rules for Cape Town because it's run properly and it seems to mostly work. And again, I'm going to say that because I was there this weekend and I observed firsthand how mostly things work in that part of the world. Whereas mostly things do not work in the rest of this country. And yet the DA, because they're held to their own higher standard, are expected, when they don't deliver on that, to please explain why you haven't done this. I'm very sick of this hypocrisy that I see. And it's usually, I mean, this is an IOL story, so already look at it with some suspicion. We know what IOL's job in South Africa is, and it's certainly not to provide us with news. The president, in a story from a more credible news organization, EWN, only just slightly, has the president has spoken out. That's Cyril Ramaphosa. He said he welcomes the Con Court's ruling on reopening of candidate registrations. The ANC's president has said that they have worked hard to ensure that they registered candidates for all wards and PR lists. They worked so hard that they didn't make the first deadline, is what I think he left out of that statement. But, you know, for the sake of trying to be understanding, the ANC's whole job as a political party is to make sure that their candidates are ready to go for elections. Only happens every 4 years. They couldn't even get that right. So on Monday, the Apex Court handed down a judgment dismissing an application by the DA and others to have a reopening of candidate nominations declared unconstitutional. So they've got the time to do it now. The ANC, according to the president, this is what I like about this news story, said they must be humble and admit where they had made mistakes while remaining open to questions from the public. You don't say. What are you going to say? Lebang?
I saw yesterday on the timeline, like ANC, well, rather Cyril has been obviously going around door to door speaking to all of our grannies. And what they're making these grannies do is just horrendous. These grannies are sitting there in bed. You can see they're holding onto their last straw, covered in ANC regalia, saying, if it weren't for you, ANC, this 350 that I get from grant money every month, it saves me. Thank you so much. Ugh. I am in awe of how they keep doing this. How do they do this so well? And all the other gokos are like, yeah, you're right. And for them, that's absolutely it. That's where the bar is. The bar is the ANC is helping me with the mere fact that I can get this grant. And now it's just like this campaign to please everybody tell your gokos to stop, because they're holding us back as a country.
It's so sad. It's elder abuse. And also... They've probably been told, if you don't play along for the cameras and you don't say these things, then we'll take your grant away, which, of course, the ANC is in no position to do. The ANC can't take your grant away. They're not allowed to. It's not the ANC giving you that money in the first place. It is the state. And that state is run by taxpayer money. And I guarantee you that the ANC is not responsible for the majority of tax that is brought in this country, as in being the most compliant tax reserve in this country. I very much doubt that ANC supporters are providing the most tax. I don't even think
our gokos know the difference.
No, they don't. And this that's why I say it's a kind of elder abuse, and we shouldn't have to tolerate it. Anyway, good luck, Cyril, and good luck to the ANC. At least they've got a couple of more days to get their act together. But really, you know, these guys...
Did he ever find his iPad?
No. I think he's still looking for it. Who knows? DeLille, Patricia DeLille, because we haven't heard from her and she's been dead quiet for the longest. You remember she's in government, huh? She's the Minister of Public Works or something.
Okay.
So
still.
Yeah, she's still
in government.
Yeah. But she's having a bitter battle with her former party, the DA. And don't for a minute think that this isn't related to elections that are coming up. And Patricia DeLille trying to let her good party, which is kind of... Put on the back burner. We had one of the guys from the Good Party on the Burning Platform the other day. But really, I don't think many people outside of the Western Cape care about the Good Party. She and a guy from the DA called, what's his name, Jordan Hill Lewis. She called him stupid after he requested that her office release the Acacia Park Parliamentary Village for affordable housing. So this is where MPs get to stay for free. Now, I don't understand. You know, you get a good salary as a member of parliament in this country. Why should you also get free housing? Does anybody know the answer? Anyway, so Patricia DeLille thinks he's stupid for even asking that. He must know, she says, that all members of parliament, all the benefits that members of parliament get, it's not decided by me. She says it's decided by a judge. It's a judge that looks at all the benefits for the members of parliament. Actually, no, I think it's the legislature that voted themselves those kinds of perks. Patricia, I'm pretty sure it's not a judge. Anyway, currently part of those benefits of all members of parliament is that the state must provide them with housing in the city of Cape Town for parliament. Those villagers have been there for years since the National Party. Why didn't he ask the National Party also to release them? Well, because he wasn't born then. He's a fairly young guy. And he said... This just proves that Patricia has been sitting there languishing in cabinet doing nothing. And he says, as far as he's concerned, if the DA are nationally in control, they will stop giving free housing to MPs. Who's not in favor of that? It's not as if they don't get paid enough to be able to rent a place when they're in Cape Town, right? Or maybe they get an allowance. Maybe they get an allowance.
They get like $100,000 a month.
Exactly.
These MPs getting like $100,000 a month. That's like a CEO salary.
Correct. And you know who's...
And these places are pretty like swag, hey? They've got like schools, swimming pools. Like, it's like a lifestyle center.
It's like a resort.
Like it's a lot. You can afford it already.
It's a resort. Trust me.
Where is it? Where is this place?
It's kind of near where Groote Schuur is. It's like in that whole Newlands area, as far as I understand. Somewhere near there.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's near the N1 and N7. It's massive, though.
Anyway.
Is that a hangover from the previous regime?
Yes. It's one of those things that, you see, this is where politicians are so venal and corrupt. They say, oh, but it's always been this way. But they could have changed that in 1994. They elected not to because they said, This is good for us. We can take home more salary because we get free housing. Sons of bitches. Anyway, you want one more?
Yeah.
One more story from the news this morning. The major categories, and nobody really cares about this, but it was the Emmys this week. And at the Emmys,
yeah, I'd imagine.
I know. I don't even know what. Let me just give you the headline here. The Crown, which is the story of Queen Elizabeth II, basically, is one of the big winners. And something called Ted Lasso. Does anyone know what that is?
Yeah, that guy's funny. He's a fake American soccer coach. Oh. Who comes over and coaches Tottenham. It's Jason Sudeikis. I've seen all the clips on YouTube, but I haven't seen the show.
So those were the two shows that managed to scoop most of the prizes. Ted Lasso and The Crown. So very exciting. I'm sure you can't wait to hear more.
Gareth, the Michaela Cole story was pretty interesting. So just in a quick nutshell, she has a story or a series, I May Destroy You. And I think after season one, Netflix had offered her more seasons, but she wasn't going to have any of the rights. So she was like, look, I'm not interested if I'm not going to have any of the rights. Long story short, she ended up still doing the show, but with another, you know, place, and she got all the rights and she even won an Emmy. So it was like a nice, you know, story for how you can keep pushing on and not letting, you know, these big companies screw you over for your original idea. So I think for me, I don't really care about the Emmys, but that one little story, I was like, that's dope, because there's people out there who are currently getting screwed over by the Netflixes and the Hulus and the whoever else. So she literally fought the system, gave them a nice little middle finger, and still went on and won away from them. So that was like, that was dope.
Well, that's a nice story to hear. Apparently, just to correct some incorrect details earlier, the MPs stay in Acacia Park, which is near Goodwood in the Cape. That's where that is. So we got it a little bit wrong. It's just a bit further to the northeast. So Acacia Park, Goodwood.
The presidential house is in Newlands.
That's
correct. I know where that is.
Yeah. That's where the president, when he's there, and the deputy president, God knows how many other people who are in that top echelon, stay also for free on our dime.
Why can't they just stay in a hotel? Like that house, or why do they need that house is insane.
But maybe it's cheaper than a hotel, in which case, I just say, like, why should you be given free accommodation as a part of your job? We don't get...
Yeah, like...
I'd love that.
I mean, like, yeah.
Between Gareth and Rina, if one of you said, you know what, Lebang, we love your work so much here at Cliff Central, here's a house.
I mean, like, even if it wasn't yours, just for you to stay for free. I mean, I don't think that's right. Like, you... I don't even want banks doing it. No way. No, you have to be responsible for your own property, whether you're renting or buying. Otherwise, you're a child. You never grow up.
Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why I'm okay with, hey, we need the guy from Luxembourg to come run my company in Italy so he gets a villa. Is that there are clear standards for, hey, chief, when you come here, in 2 years' time, if our revenues aren't up 2 billion, you're not going to not only have this house, you're the hell out of here. With the president, my problem is, what are your standards for delivery? Why do you get that house?
Just win the next election by giving out T-shirts and elder abuse.
Jesus.
All right, so that's all we got time for in the news this morning, but it seems like there's always plenty to talk about there, and we could carry on all morning. I'd prefer if we speak to someone who is a regular friend of the show and someone who we love to check in with. He is JJ Cornish. And it is time to catch up with him in Africanalysis, which is our bi-monthly feature. It's brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. It's looking at what's happening on the African continent. Bonjour, Jean-Jacques Cornish. How are you, sir?
Bonjour to you. I'm immensely well, thanks. I've just taken a sip of some elderberry wine. I'm so well that if I was any better, I'd have to tell the cops. You know, no Mlungu deserves to be this well in South Africa.
All right, so let's hear what's going on. South Africa is one thing, but Africa is always there's always something going on. Now, one guy who manages to get an enormous amount of press, both because there are huge fans of his and there are also people who are terribly concerned about him, is old Paul Kagame of Rwanda. And he is a fairly ruthless autocrat by anyone's standards. So what's been happening in Rwanda recently? And tell us about the story about the star from Hotel Rwanda. Well, the hero, rather, not the movie star, but the hero who actually was the man who inspired the story of Hotel Rwanda.
Paul Rusesabagina. Mm. And he was portrayed by Don Cheadle in that movie. With the 94 genocide, he was manager of the Hotel de Mille Collines, the Hotel of a Thousand Hills in Rwanda. In Kigali, and he saved more than 1,200 Tutsis who were going to be massacred in that genocide. He put them in the hotel and kept the authorities at bay, for which he became a hero. And I mean, he won things, including the U.S. Medal of Freedom. Mm-hmm. But with the fame that he got, he became an ardent critic of Paul Kagame. Now. Challenging that man is deadly, quite literally deadly, right. As Patrick Karegeya, who was hanged in his suite at the Michelangelo Hotel, learned, hanged by a curtain sash in his suite.
That was here in South Africa, right?
Yes, oh. At the Michelangelo Hotel, right. Yeah. As Faustin Kayumba Nyamwasa, a former general who he fell out with, who was shot in front of his house in Johannesburg. Sure. South Africa withdrew its ambassador to Rwanda in protest of that, against that. But now what has happened is Rusesabagina, he has become a critic, or was an ardent critic of Paul Kagame, and he was on a lecture tour. He got onto a private plane in Dubai thinking that he was flying to Burundi, which, as you know, neighbors Rwanda in the Great Lakes District.
Back, right.
This is now a year ago. And the plane landed in Rwanda, and he was taken off it. He was effectively abducted.
Wow.
And the show trial began. He was charged with supporting the Rwanda Movement for Democratic Change, a rebel movement that killed 9 people in parts of the country. He refused to participate in this, absolutely refused, saying it's an absolute sham. His lawyer was abducted, and he wasn't able to see a lawyer put in his place. So he didn't have access to the lawyer. He didn't have anything to do with the court case. He wouldn't participate in it, saying it's an absolute sham. Now he's been sentenced for supporting terrorists. They said, well, he's an old man, he's 67, and he's, it's a first offense, so we'll... We'll only give him 25 years.
Oh, my God. So basically,
there we go.
A show trial. And this is the way that...
absolute show trial.
This is the way that Paul Kagame gets rid of people who he doesn't like and who have stood up against him.
At your absolute peril do you take him on. Rusesabagina is a Belgian citizen, and he lives in Belgium.
Yes.
And so they are going to put pressure on him. And I see that the U.S. administration is also expressing misgivings, as are others, human rights groups, all the normal people who complain about what Kagame does. You know, the people who like him are those who see that he keeps order in his country, and that the streets are free of litter, and that the cars are clean. By order, if you drive a dirty car in Rwanda, you're going to get into serious trouble.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of order they like. Not that they've ever had to live there or put up with the human rights deficiencies. Here we go. And it's terribly sad. I feel very, very sorry for this man.
I mean,
his family are absolutely distraught. The thing is, I mean, he should be freed. He was abducted.
So given the choice in a place like Rwanda of whether you want the cleanest streets and cars and people mostly behaving themselves, at least publicly, so that it looks nice, you know, that it's all about appearances. Given that, or actual free speech and actual rights to dissent from the majority opinion or the opinion of the president, I don't think there are many people who'd say, well, I'd rather have clean streets than free speech. That's how, you know, only the stupidest among us would want that. And yet Rwanda is held up as some kind of paragon by some. Anyway, it's interesting stuff, JJ. What about what's going on in Algeria? We've spoken about Algeria before, and it seems that France and Algeria, there's a whole lot of trouble there because the French president has had to apologize to veterans who fought on France's side in Algeria. It sounds a lot like what the successors to Joe Biden will have to do when they apologize to veterans of the Afghan war. And they probably already have started to apologize to them, saying, you know, we're sorry we wasted 20 years of your life, or so many more in some cases. So what's going on there, and how does this Algeria-France thing square up?
Well, Algeria-France is terribly interesting, you know. I mean, I'll never forget the time I spent there. I think I might have mentioned this before. My bodyguard was a jiu-jitsu expert, and he then told me that they had a match against France. Mm-hmm. And he said, I gave this guy, his French opponent, a good lesson. It wasn't a question of beating him in an international judo match. It was, I gave him a lesson. And, you know, the parallels between the relationship between the Algerians and the French and the Boers and the Brits are quite remarkable. You know, the one is, it's all about historical horrors and memories. And I couldn't believe how alike they were. The War of Liberation in Algeria was an exceedingly bitter one. Mm. They have a monument there, and they maintain not a single Algerian family went untouched by that war between 1954 and 1962.
Wow.
Now, there was a group called the Harkis, H-A-R-K-I-S, about 200,000 of them that fought on the British, on the French side in that very, very bitter war.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10,000 of them were France left. You know, when they left Algeria, they did everything they could to hold on. They would have given up every other French colony in order to hold on to Algeria. It was absolutely vital to them, but they couldn't. The Algerians never would have allowed that.
Hmm.
And when they left, they left the Harkis behind. Some of them were taken to France, where they were sequestrated. Gareth, they were put behind fences in France. Okay. You know, this is how to treat your allies. But tens of thousands of them were actually massacred back in Algeria by the vengeful Algerians against their own people. Now, Emmanuel Macron, who has specialized in making apologies that don't really mean I'm sorry, but he said that they've apologized and that there will be reparations. That's the important thing. But it's a very, very bleak chapter in French history. It's not a very happy chapter in Algerian history either. But right. That these people, their family, should get some reparation, I think, is apposite.
Now, what about Zambia? Because we also had lots of people crowing about Zambia, and they managed to hold a more or less free or fair election recently. And this was in the middle of COVID, and people were hugely impressed with them. But their new president, how's he doing?
Well, he's just gone to the United Nations General Assembly. I mean, if I miss anything in the world, it's covering the United Nations General Assembly. I remember I went there in 1975 for my first, where I met none other than Idi Amin Dada. Yeah. I gate crashed his reception. And I walked up to him and I said, sir, you didn't actually invite me, but I am from the South African media and I badly wanted to meet you. And he looked at me and said, are you racist? I said, no, I believe I'm not. He said, then you are welcome. He made this incredible speech. It was a remarkable time. The people you meet at that, I mean, it's the gathering of world leaders. It's fantastic. I mean, Joe Biden, your favorite, he's the star of the show today. The debate begins with Brazil, always traditionally begins it. Now, this General Assembly will be dominated, of course, by climate change and by COVID this year round.
Mm.
And some of the leaders will make it virtual as they did last year. But Hakainde Hichilema goes off to Zambia with, you know, the Zambians are cash strapped. They're the first country to have reneged on their international debt, and you know, because of problems that they're having. And he goes off, he takes a scheduled flight and goes off with two cabinet ministers, traveling very light. A perfect example to us. I mean, we don't need to be taking these massive teams.
No.
And certainly the Africans. You know, it's the old big man in Africa stuff that you had to have a bigger jet and more people on your team to show that you were a more important person than your neighbors. But here we have Hakainde Hichilema doing this, which is great news. Shades of Joyce Bondo, you remember the Malawian who sold her presidential debt. I cursed her for that many times. If ever you flew on a scheduled flight with Joyce Bondo, it meant that when the plane landed, you'd better stay seated for about 2 hours till they cleared her and her people through. The inconvenience that it caused to ordinary travelers was enormous, but it saved the Malawians lots of money. Sadly, though, it must be recorded that Joyce Bondo was ousted after the largest corruption scandal in Malawi's history.
But this guy, so he seems to be making the right moves in terms of saving his country money. I mean, that never happens with politicians. They love to spend taxpayers' money on things like private jets. But this is
he's a businessman, so he's made his own money. So I think he knows, he understands it. You know, many of these politicians went into politics knowing they were going to make money because, you know, from some countries they don't have industries and mines. If you're capable and you have any talent, you go into politics because that's where you're going to make the moolah.
Jean-Jacques, let me ask you something quickly about South Africa, because we, you know, you told us this Rwanda story. You just told us about Zambia. Does our government still side with people like the Hotel Rwanda guy, Rusesa Gabina? Do we still make statements to support free speech in Africa and to support liberal ideas and democracy? And do we still get involved in that stuff, or do we just kind of sit like a big potato and say nothing?
Are we using the moral high ground of the Rainbow Nation? Well, is what you're asking me?
What's left
now?
When it comes.
When it comes to Paul Rusesabagina, I'm expecting them to say something because of our very tetchy relationship with Rwanda. You know, no matter what you feel about human rights, if somebody comes into your country and slays one of their political opponents, you know, in one of your best hotels, I think as a government you're bound to say something. And I'm expecting them to at least express some misgivings about it, because this was such a patently show trial.
Yeah.
So let's wait and see. Let's see. Check on this one.
I'm not going to hold my breath, because it doesn't seem like we ever manage to say the right thing or side with the right people in international relations anymore. Don't know what Durko is doing. I know that the minister there is Naledi Pandor, who by and large has made the right noises occasionally, but I'm just not seeing terribly much of it. So I wondered if you'd maybe heard of anything in your circles with all the...
I think she's a very good minister. You know, she still speaks with that sort of South London accent, you know, and she takes the mickey out of herself like that too. She said, I met her once at the Queen's birthday, and she said, well, I found my brother, you know, and I said, Where do you think I'm going tonight? He said, dunno. I said, Queen's birthday, innit? He said, oh, no, never, you know. But she's exceedingly bright, and she was educated in Britain. And I think she's doing, you know, I'm not going to accuse any South African cabinet minister of doing a bang-up job, but she's certainly up there in performing.
I want to like her, but I'm just, you know, the International Relations Department hasn't covered themselves in glory. You never forget Maite Nguana Mashabane and such people, because they really did a terrible job while they were in there. And I don't know if we've squandered any of that goodwill and that moral high ground that you speak of. Maybe you were being sarcastic, but what's left of it doesn't get used in the right places anymore.
I believe that we have squandered it enormously. Mm. You know, we were an ordinary country. And then at some point we managed to punch above our weight. But I'm afraid that we have become very ordinary again.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, JJ. It's a bit of a depressing note to leave it on, but thank you for updating us on the goings-on of our own continent, stuff that we like to hear about and things that I think many people miss in the mainstream media. JJ Cornish, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Very good. And this is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. When we come back in the next few minutes, got lots of other good things to talk about. We're also going to talk about This Is Us, which I'll tell you about in a short while, and plenty more. It is a Tuesday morning on cliffcentral.com. Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Cliffcentral.com.